Good afternoon. Welcome. It's Sunday, April 24th, 2016. This is our final podcast. Just a brief reminder to our audience, if you have any cell phones or if you need to unwrap potato chip bags or anything, you're welcome to make noise and react spontaneously to the presentation. But you know, we're just trying to keep all the reactions organic.
This is the theater one, after all.
Oh, yes. The podcast recording will last about 30 minutes. Just so you know, there will be a group of people coming in. Anyone who's straggling behind in about 10 minutes, we'll just have one wave for people to come in. But other than that, I'm happy to hand it over to Edie Demas, who is going to be moderating our third and final podcast.
Thank you. Yes, I'm thrilled to be here on day three of the forum, and thrilled to see so many of you still here. Yay! Today we're going to be talking about theater for young audiences, and at the risk of sounding like a broken record over the course of these three podcasts, I remain absolutely honored and humbled to be asked to moderate these conversations. As many of you may know, I'm an alum of, I have both my MA and my PhD from the program in educational theater. And for several semesters, actually taught the Theater for Young Audiences course here. Have a couple of students in the audience. And was remembering on my way up to the podcast this afternoon, I guess it is afternoon, yes, that I'm pretty certain I'm correct in saying that my very first engagement as a performer in a TYA production was here in the what's now the Frederick Lowe Theater in a production of Mother Hicks by Suzanne Zader. Probably that was like 1989. So it really feels like a full circle moment. I'm delighted to be joined by our panelists. And again, one more disclosure for me, and then I'll move back into a more official moderator mode. One of our panelists, Paul Brewster, is a member of Trusty Theater, Trusty Sidekick Theater Company. He'll introduce himself more fully in a moment, but I am a board member of the company, which has a big Ed Theater connection, which Paul will elaborate on, and also collaborated creatively with the company a few years ago when they were first doing new work. So just to disclose those connections at the start. And Paul, why don't you continue to introduce yourself?
Sure. So good afternoon. I'm Paul Brewster, artistic producer for the Trusty Sidekick Theater Company, and honored to be here to represent the company, which, as Edie mentioned, many of us are former students and graduates of this program, including Robert Stevenson, a company member who's here with us today. And so we've taken a lot of our skill set, the toolbox that we've learned as educators and artists here from the educational theater program into our work with the company. Trusty Sidekick Theater Company is a New York-based theater for young audiences company creating bold, original productions for young people and their families. And we are a group of artists, multidisciplinary in nature, and often using site-specific sites for our work, looking to activate new spaces with the work that we do. We've had partnerships with the University Settlement, Park Avenue Armory, and most recently Lincoln Center Education, which we'll talk about that work and more shortly.
Okay. And our second panelist,
okay.
Tim.
Hello, I'm Tim Webb, and I'm artistic director and CEO and writer and other things, I suppose, for Oily Cart, which celebrates its 35th anniversary this October. And I'm very honoured to be invited to take part in this, and indeed to do a masterclass on the opening night of this conference. And Oily Cart is a theatre company which makes work for two kinds of audiences, really. Young people who are from 2 to 6 years old, with or without a disability. We call them all comers. And those performances tend to take place in theatres around the UK, mainly in the winter. But the rest of the year, spring and autumn, we make work for young people who've got serious learning disabilities. They fall into two categories. I'm going to use the UK terminology, so stand back. This might be death by acronym. But one of the audiences is people who have an autistic spectrum condition, and the other audience are people who have sensory and cognitive impairments, often medical support needs, and in the UK they're called profound and multiple learning disabilities. So for both of those audiences, there are the profound and multiple learning disabilities and the autistic spectrum conditions. There are similarities, but there are also big differences. And also, all the people who are subsumed under these labels are all very different from one another. So the essence of our work is that it's multisensory. We can't rely upon the theatrical standby senses of seeing and hearing to communicate with people. We also have to deal with scent and touch and the kinesthetic sense, the sense of the body out of itself in space. And the work has to be highly interactive. We tend to work with small numbers, rather like an audience like this. But so we can see into your eyes and see how something's proceeding or whether we need to do things differently. We want to be able to respond to the audience. And we like to think that when it's going well, the audiences are the co-creators of our pieces. We don't know what's going to happen at the end. The audiences are also benefit from different kinds of performance, like performances which challenge the usual ideas about duration and location. So you'll find us doing theatre in hydrotherapy pools and on trampolines, and also which challenge notions of the duration, and so we'll have performances which fundamentally last a week, sometimes 2 weeks. We embed characters in situations, and we find this, we don't do it just idly, we do it because it works better that way. We connect where we wouldn't connect otherwise.
Okay, well, thank you. So the first question that came to my mind when I thought about today's conversation was that Oilikart and Trusty Sidekick have in common the fact that they've sort of broken several different kinds of conventions, both in terms of the form and structure of the companies themselves and the audience relationship that you just so beautifully described, Tim. I love this idea of co-creators. And I think you have that in common, but in different ways. It comes out in different ways in the companies. But I wonder if each of you could share an example of this kind of breaking with the norm or tradition in your companies and the challenges that come along with that.
Sure, I'll start with at Trusty Sidekick. We are an itinerant theater company with no permanent home or brick or mortar that we are working in, and so we often describe ourselves as agile. And though we may have a staff or core group of people that work on our projects, we're constantly responding to the new projects that we're in. Creating a structure that makes sense to create the work at hand. And so that means that while you may be in one role for a staff position in the company, you're in an entirely different capacity in leveraging other skills on a project, and that's encouraged. We understand that there's so much that each company member can bring to the table, which can make it hard to explain what we do or how we are involved in different projects. As Edie mentioned, our development process, we think of our young audience as our dramaturgs, and looking to collaborate with them and get feedback from them on the process. So oftentimes when we are creating a project, we're going into the classrooms or into community groups that we are working with to run workshops that test the content of the show and elicit responses and to see where the narrative wants to go, how it's responding for that audience, and where to move from there. In terms of our relationship with the audience, we really look to blur the lines between reality and imagination. So when our audience arrives to our shows, we're really looking at a slow immersion into the world of our play. And for us to really capitalize on young people not having predefined notions of what the theater-going experience is about. You know, we haven't yet learned the behaviors of filing past a security guard and an usher to sit in our ticketed seat and watch across a proscenium line, but rather to enter a space, be greeted by a cast member, have a necklace of dirt draped over our over our necks, and then write a fear on a piece of paper that goes into that, that we can carry with us and then have a catharsis with by the end of the show. So really looking to blend those lines. So the challenge there becomes that we've done a lot of work with different age ranges, with different ability groups, and so when our family audiences come to see us, they'll say, oh, you're the company who, you're the one that. And we often are saying, yes, and we'll work with this population. Yes, we do 2 to 5 year old work, and we love working with ASD populations and 8 year olds and up. So it's an interesting thing to remain agile as we are in certain projects and being exposed in different pockets of this great big city.
It's tricky too. I think one of the challenges in that is building an audience. Mm. Because of, you know, especially with families, they age out and then, you know, fall off the parents' radar. And
especially since when we take up to 2 years to create a work, and we're not really thinking about our season or slots to fill. So sometimes we'll be working on a 2 to 5 year old project, and then there won't be anything for that 2 to 5 year old for years, but then maybe they'll pop up in the 8+ that we do years later. So it's been a challenge to understand who our audience is and how old they are today.
And what that sort of rhythm is. And so mm-hmm. so just to situate, I'm not sure if we said this, but Trusty Sidekick is about 5 years old this year, right?
Correct. We'll be celebrating our 5-year anniversary.
And interesting to think about those cycles and then coming back to Oilekart and Tim at the company at 35 years, and how when you introduced yourself, you spoke about in the winter we do this work and the rest of the year. And so it sounds like you've figured out a cycle of development and performance production that works for you all.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there is a cycle in the Oilekart, and it's to do with, our wish to get to audiences on a regular basis, and not just to keep actually going back to the same audiences, but also to develop audiences in different parts of the country and even different parts of the world. You know, we think we've got something to say, and we want to get around and say it. So that is an important concept to us. But it's also an important concept to the Arts Council of England, who are our primary funder. Who you know, basically, you've got a contract with them. We have to deliver so many performances, and so many different kinds of performances too. And there are other assumptions that we make, that we think they actually fund us to. To create and to be a sort of a development arm. Mm-hmm. I don't think they'd be happy if we suddenly started doing familiar pieces with recognisable titles. I wouldn't like to risk that.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's a wonderful thing to hear you say, because many times, of course, especially in the U.S., I think it's the converse. You know, the funding sources are looking, or the touring venues or the producing organisations are looking for familiar.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just think that side of the business is taken care of by an awful lot of companies
in
the UK.
Yeah.
You know, if we don't do it, no one's going to come to any harm, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, the most recognisable title we ever did was this thing called Conference of the Birds, which is a 13th century Sufi poem title. Well, this was for children with severe learning disabilities, I should point out, too. Mm-hmm. One thing I'd like to say about the Oilekart is I'm here, but it's not just me, and it never has been. Like right, and this is, I think, one of the most interesting things about the Oilekart. There are three of us who founded the company, and those three people are still around. So one of them is called Max Reinhardt, and he's a musician. He's also a world music DJ on BBC Radio 3. So he's very familiar with different kinds of musicians, different kinds of music. He's up to his ears in it. And then the other person is Claire DeLune, who is our head of design and has designed and with a quite a big team, made all of the shows over the years. And what's great about the Audicart is we're all based on one site, so there's like a rehearsal room and there's an office and there are workshops. So we're all, Claire and Max and myself are all obviously talking to one another all the time. We haven't got fed up with one another after 35 years. We're also in a position where if something changes in the rehearsal room, almost immediately the people in the workshops making stuff will know about it. Mm-hmm. You know, we could turn on a sixpence. Mm-hmm. You know what sixpences are.
I do. Or turn on a dime.
Turn on a dime.
Dime works too.
Yes. There was a millionaire, Nubar Gulbenkian, who made a lot of money and actually put a lot of money into the arts in the UK. And he was being interviewed once and he said, oh yeah, my organisation could turn on the sixpence, whatever that is. So that's an important thing to say about, not that, no, the other bit, about how we work as a team and it's very flexible. And also how it's not that hierarchical, I don't think, in theatre terms. And what applies to us applies to people who come into the company. I mean, some guys have been around like 10 or 8 years with us now. And the idea with the company is to make spaces or allow spaces to happen for these people so that their talents will flourish. You know, it's not so that I can come back from my penthouse with a manuscript and say, do this.
I have it, the next masterpiece.
Yes, terrible idea.
I've had the privilege of seeing one Audicart show at the New Victory Theatre, Ring a Ding Ding.
That's the one.
Right? Yeah. Which I thoroughly enjoyed.
Good.
And so I'm going to go out on a limb and see if I can draw a conclusion about the three of you, which is to me in that performance, and I believe from reading about your work and that the way that music design or production aesthetics and story and theater are inextricably sort of entwined like a strand of DNA in the production seems to be mirrored in the company structure that you just described as well. Does that sound about right?
I can definitely see where you're coming from, and it is there's a lot of truth in it. It's the fact that I think we're not like many theatre companies in the UK, say, who are sort of led by the word and the story. We're as likely to be led by a kind of music or the work of a particular artist. And we think that those things, different art forms, should be obviously in a synthetic piece like theatre, but also it enables us to communicate with different kinds of audiences more effectively than a more conventionally structured and created piece of theatre could.
Sure, I was thinking as you were speaking that the idea of multi-sensory and multidisciplinary go hand in hand.
Yeah, because one of the things that working with people with severe disabilities over the years has made us do is made us think about very hard about what is theatre. Mm-hmm. Because so what is theatre for an audience that can't see it? Mm-hmm. And what is theatre for an audience that can't hear it? Mm-hmm. And what is theatre for an audience that can't remember at the end of the show what happened at the beginning? So, and what does that do for narrative? And what does that do for character development? Mm-hmm. But you know, our engagement is to involve all the people who may be affected by these issues. But then you end up making something that's sometimes more like, you know, sort of performance art. Mm-hmm. You know, if you wanted to start categorising it. But we're not doing it to, sort of actually break down the barriers of theatre. We're doing it because there's an audience out there that we've got to communicate with, and this is how you do it. And I'm just thinking,
keep going. You're on a roll, it's great.
Okay, that's my trouble. Nowadays we do a lot of work with people on the autistic spectrum, and people on the autistic spectrum who are primarily non-verbal, you know, and often exhibit quite challenging behaviour. And I'm proudest when we get feedback from work that we've done in public venues, where, for example, in this show we did last year called The Bounce, which was all set on trampolines. And what happened was, in public venues, the young people who were on the spectrum would come along with their mom or their dad or other members of their family, and they would come into our world, and they would realise that it was for them. You know, we were creating it for them. It was their space. And there are a number of comments, of which I'm very proud, where the parents say, I feel that I am not connected with my child. It feels to me, this is a particular example, that my child is in a kind of bubble. He doesn't want to communicate with me. He doesn't express affection. He doesn't look at me. We don't touch. And this is a child who's actually, you know, 14 years old. Right. But when we came into the world that you'd created, it became a world for him, and it was also a world for me. And we were together in this third space that had been created, and she said, I felt that I was having this relationship with my son that was extremely rare. And I think, okay, I'll do that.
Yeah,
if that's what we're doing, I'll sign up for it. Yeah. I'll keep doing that. You know, that's brilliant.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
So there was able to be a shared experience.
Yes, yes. And it's like there's a sort of, you know, the shared Goedekart wonderland, we call them, in which people can come together who otherwise move in separate orbits.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting work, particularly for kids on the spectrum.
Yeah.
Is something Goedekart and Trustee Sidekick share. And in fact, there had a very unique, almost mentoring kind of relationship, thanks to a commission from Lincoln Center Education.
Yeah.
Also with proud Ed Theater alumni at the helm of that commission in Russell Granite and Alex Sarian. And so I wonder if we could focus in maybe on how the companies work together on that piece and maybe what came out of it for Trustee in terms of learning about this shared space.
Sure, absolutely. So this production was commissioned. It was the first time that a major cultural organization had commissioned a piece to be specifically designed for this audience in the United States. And so Trustee was tapped to develop that piece because we were creating innovative work for young audiences. And it was amazing to have that privilege to be mentored by Tim, Claire DeLune, and the Goedekart team. It took several years to chart the course for that production, and the mentorship was a way of giving us a formative assessment throughout the entire process. Here's what we're thinking of. How has that worked in your experience? As you mentioned, we're less than 10 years old at this point, so to draw on the wealth of experience from a company that had been working for decades with these populations was invaluable. So specifically, some of the things that we really learned, those nuggets that Tim and Claire DeLune shared with us, included the idea of the narrative structure you were talking about earlier. We were really intrigued at how do you create a show that has some arc to it, but then also can stand alone moment to moment. We were really intrigued with how do you create a show that has no right way to experience it. And so the show that became our production was called Up and Away, loosely based on the Jules Verne story of Around the World in 80 Days, where the Fogg family has come together to celebrate their 1,000th balloon ride. And the audience, being the hero of every adventure that we put on stage, kind of intrinsic to our name, is there to help celebrate this 1,000th balloon ride. And so that episodic nature, as well as the jazz structure that Oily Cart employs, this idea of one-on-one performance between a cast member and their audience member that is responding, like you said, to the what the young person is bringing in that moment and what that person is looking to experience, finding that way into the communication, whether that be through a fan that's simulating wind or a mist of the cloud that we're passing through, figuring out those multiple ways in and being in tune, and sometimes not listening to the caregiver or pushing that boundary. With so many times over, we heard, we've never seen a young person engage in this way. We've never seen my child engage in this way. And it was because we weren't creating a medical experience or an academic experience right. for them. It was about creating an artistic moment, a shared experience between them. Yeah. And your quote earlier reminded me of a quote that a parent shared with us after experiencing the show of, it's hard for her son to be present for productions, but that she felt in a beautiful reversal that our production had been present for him, which was like, okay, we feel right. like we took everything that Tim and Claire de Lune had shared with us and sort of tried to apply it to what we did.
That's a great kind of touchstone for working, I think, with all audiences, for all comers. I love that phrase. I'm going to steal it.
It's a 5% royalty.
How do we make work that is present for the audience? It isn't just, you know, a lot of work can sort of be navel-gazing. It's what we want to
do. Yeah.
What we want to explore, what we want to create.
Yeah.
And we forget about the reciprocity of that kind of sacred contract.
Yeah.
So how can we as artists be present for everybody is a lovely way to think.
Yeah, and I mean, just to say that it was a great experience for Claire and myself to work with Trusty Sidekick, you know, who were a brilliant company, and it was an honor, and we hope that we contributed that. I can hear that, you know.
Well, the biggest thing really, I mean, there was such fear. We realized so early on that we were in a political minefield when it came talking to parents and institutions. There were a lot of people to, quote unquote, please. Yeah. And then to go into a workshop with Tim where he had us literally put our head in a box and scream and then pass it was, okay, this is about just being here and not approaching it with fear, but approaching it with joy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember that.
Yes. Yeah.
It was a terrible thing to do to people.
It paid off, though.
Yeah, who'd have thought it? What's interesting about it is in the business of what the Oily Cart does is it's a company that identifies a particular audience, whether it's babies or it's people on the autistic spectrum or it's what, you know, and we've done various different kinds of audiences, and what we're looking at is like what will engage people who may have, you know, different sensory setups than us, what may engage people that have different intellectual setups than us. But when you come down to it, in the process of devising and rehearsal in the early stages, you have to have things. What's your touchstone? You know, you get to a stage where you can have previews and you get kids in. We're actually based in a school where they have this thing called the language unit, where there are kids who are on the autism spectrum and they're forever being brought across as the guinea pigs, you know, and do you like this, do you like that? But actually a lot of the time it's me and Max who are the audience for the early development stuff. And in the end, we have to like it.
Yeah.
Because, so you're kind of, you're getting back to this personal evaluation, you know, is this really powerful art?
Mm-hmm.
Or are we kidding ourselves? You know, because you think, well, one of the things we talk about is people who might have locked-in syndrome. So you know, like people might be affected by strokes, and they have no way of communicating actually what they're feeling. So they might be, people in our audiences who are sitting there as cognitively alive as any of us in this sure. room, but mm-hmm. they were thinking, while we, you know, stroke them with a fan or offer them a scent, you know, why don't these clowns just bugger off so I could get back listening to that lovely Bach that we were listening to before they rolled up.
Right.
Because if you do that, if you think that way about the audience, then you don't do anything, well, hope you don't do anything patronising.
Right.
Right, that this has to be good enough for anybody. And also good enough for people who are just going to experience this as a succession of beautiful moments. So there does have to be a structure for those people who are thinking, you know, is this really just one damn thing after another? No, but it tends to have the structure of a piece of music more, or a painting, or a poem. You know, it's not this sort of temporal resolving thing that, you know, you tend to find in a script, standard script.
And then becoming important to build in both the multisensory and the support tools to the dramaturgy of the piece to the aesthetic, so that for us, when we have a visual agenda for Up and Away, it became the flight map, so that you're able to track where you are in the story if that's how you want to engage in this, but then not have it be, you know, a classroom agenda on the board that's just there because this is good for young people with autism, but for rather to serve the story.
Well, thank you both. We have to, unfortunately, wrap up. I feel like we could really keep going. I wonder if, as we close, you could sort of leave us each with a brief wish for the field of young audiences or the folks that may listen to this podcast to be thinking about. And I'll give mine first, which is, listening to you all, I'm inspired to think about how institutions can follow the lead of somebody like Lincoln Center or the Arts Council, and in terms of commissioning and funding structures that support the kind of peer mentorship that happened here, and the deep commitment to audiences and this kind of co-creation, collaboration, reflective practice model of developing new work. So that's what's on my mind. We just got to go up and dig up those funding streams. But Paul, do you have any wishes?
Yeah, if that can occur, then my wish is for us to have more artists that are doing this work. We know that, especially if we're creating small, intimate theater pieces, we can't serve everyone. Not one company can serve the whole need that's here for both young audiences and people with disabilities. And so just not waiting for permission to do so. My wish is that you create high-quality work and then share it and come to forums like the NYU Forum in order to have continued dialogue about the work we're doing out in the field.
I think my wish is in a way very similar to Paul's, because we found that the sort of theatre that we make has an enormous demand, and a demand that actually, with the model of company that we run, which is small and intimate and, you know, reactive and organic, we can't possibly sort of answer the need. Or, you know, people say, well, why don't you just clone yourselves, and there'd be six oily carts going around and six vans all over England? And we think, because that would be really boring to run. So what do you do about it? So what we've been doing about it is actually helping other companies in the UK, in Northern Ireland, and in the Republic, but also in Canada, and in some small way anyway, you know, in New York with Trusty Psychic, to actually create their version of this work, and that way we do the important task of getting out to all these people who, you know, will really get a lot out of this stuff, I do believe. But it isn't just the oily carts trip.
Right. Yeah. Well, I do believe that too, and I think we will have an audience of listeners who believe the same thing. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having
us.
Thank
you.
Thank you.